Hello, my name is Cheryl Cohen, and I'm the president of Arthritis Consumer Experts, or ACE. ACE provides education and training to people with arthritis. We also help to empower people living with all forms of arthritis to take control of their disease and to take action in healthcare and research decision making. I'm also a person living with rheumatoid arthritis. We're here today with Dr. Deanne Lacaille, and we're going to be speaking with Dr. Lacaille about what it's like to become an arthritis research scientist and certainly about her own work as a researcher. But first, a little bit about Dr. Lacaille. She's an assistant professor at the Division of Rheumatology in the Department of Medicine at the University of British Columbia, and she's also a research scientist at the Arthritis Research Centre of Canada based in Vancouver. Welcome to the program, Dr. Lacaille.
It's a pleasure to be here, Cheryl.
Super. We're just thrilled to have you again. There was huge response to the program that we had with you last year about arthritis and the workplace, and we're certainly excited to be speaking with you again today.
Thank you.
We really want to focus our conversation, as I mentioned at the start, on what it's like to become an arthritis research scientist, what your own process was, and then, of course, leading into a discussion with you about your work at the Arthritis Research Centre of Canada, some of your recently completed projects, and hopefully some of the projects that are going on now. Our listeners are always really keen to hear about cutting-edge research, and certainly in the area that you work in, at the more clinical and social impact end, and also about how your work at the Arthritis Research Centre of Canada has been helped by your membership in the Canadian Arthritis Network. And then, of course, we're going to talk a little bit about your exciting nomination as a WCA Women of Distinction, Woman of Distinction, I should say. And then maybe closing the program with a little bit about what your thoughts are on the future of arthritis research in Canada. So for the listener and for yourself, that's a bit of an overview as to what we're going to discuss. And let's start with your thoughts. When you were a med school student, how did they lure you into, one, becoming a rheumatologist as the first step to becoming someone who would go on to do research, and then how you got interested in research and why you love it so much? You clearly do. You're a very accomplished scientist.
Well, actually, it's an interesting, we all have different journeys, and it's an interesting way how I ended up in research, because for me, actually, it was really totally a serendipitous thing. It just happened. I'm a very curious person, and when I was a medical student, I thought, oh, I should try doing some research as a summer project, just a summer job. I had no intention of going into research, but I just wanted to try it out just to see what it was like, and turned out that I really enjoyed it, and it just totally challenged what I had intended to do. I still didn't think I was going to go into it, but I just kept on doing a little bit of it here and there along my training and kept on really liking it. So then I thought, well, maybe I should do a career out of it, and that's what got me interested. And the reason I like it so much, I think, is because, as I said, I'm curious. You know, my family always teases me that I ask so many questions all the time. So for me, being a researcher, it means that I have questions that come up, and I can just think through these questions and find the answers. It's very exciting. It's fun. I like it.
And the questions, I imagine, that you have early on, you probably need some help in terms of shaping those questions, because you're not quite sure, I gather, from when you're a med student and moving into the area of research, how to actually go about doing it. Did you have a mentor at the very early stage, or did you have someone who sort of tried to rope you into the research community? Because I think curiosity, that's a prime characteristic for being a researcher.
Definitely.
You have to be curious.
If you're not curious, you're not going to follow through.
Yeah.
But you bring a very important point, which is that it's one thing to have a question, but it's a total art. I mean, the art of research is being able to take a simple question and developing it into a research question, which is not the same thing, and sort of developing the whole methodology around it to being able to answer it. So it sort of makes it very simple when you say, oh, I have a question and I'll answer it. But it's actually not sort of as simple as that.
And right.
I think the key to a good researcher is someone who's able to ask the right questions and ask them in the right way that you actually can answer them with whatever data is available to you or with the research that you're able to do. And that's a lot of what when you're trained as a researcher, that's a lot of what you're trained at. And I always tell people when I'm, have rheumatology fellows or people who want to do research, we spend so much time just working on the question,
right,
getting the question right,
right,
and getting a question that's actually answerable.
Right, because if the question is good, let me just test this out with you then, because if the question is good and you develop sort of a systematic way of asking the question, whether it be to 10 people or 10,000 people, the answers you get back from them will be good quality answers. And then you can sort through the answers and hopefully come up with a global answer that will be applicable to people like those that participated in the study.
That's right.
Okay.
And if you don't ask the question right, you're not going to get back what you really wanted to know.
Right. Right. So when you're in med school and someone attracts you into the field and you are curious and you actually are willing to go forward into a research career, tell us how that works. So you graduate med school.
So you, and actually the other point you asked me was about you need a good, it's one thing to be curious.
Yeah.
You need positive experiences early on.
Oh, right.
So
okay.
Those are really important.
Okay.
So, and I was very lucky that way. So
okay.
I had very positive experiences very early on where, you can put a lot of work into research, especially as a student or a trainee, and not necessarily get a lot out of it.
Right.
But I was in an environment where those were very positive experiences and where I actually had the opportunity of taking the projects from beginning to end and getting a publication and presenting at conferences as a student. It was so intimidating. And, I had a great mentor right from the beginning, John Esdale,
right,
who's a very accomplished researcher. And he sort of never really tried to sort of twist my arm into it, but it certainly was a very positive experience. And he's, certainly I can... I'm certain that a lot of my interest in it was influenced by those interactions.
Yeah.
So the process, if you go at it from being a clinician first.
Yeah.
So after you're done your clinical training, so for being a rheumatologist, it means going to medical school. After medical school, doing a residency in internal medicine, because rheumatology is a subspecialty of internal medicine. So that's 3 or 4 years. I did 4 years. I wanted my full internal medicine.
Right.
And then doing 2 years of rheumatology training. And after that, if you want to be a researcher, you have to have additional training in, if you're going to be a basic science researcher, then you need additional training in the basic science field that you want to enter.
Right.
But even if you want to be a clinician researcher, doing clinical work and doing clinical research is two completely different, it's like apples and oranges.
Describe them to us then. What is clinical research versus being a clinician?
So, being a clinician means seeing patients in your own private practice or in the hospital, and although you really get a good sense of what's there for treatment and a lot of what the issues are, when you want to do clinical research, it means that you want to ask questions. If it's epidemiological research, for example, you want to ask questions about the disease at the level of a population and find out answers. So you want to know, for example, do people with rheumatoid arthritis have a greater risk of developing heart disease,
right,
for example?
Okay.
So that's epidemiology research, is when you're sort of looking at issues around a disease at the level of a population.
So these are big studies, then.
Those are big studies, big question.
Okay.
As opposed to clinical research, which is you want to know, for example, does medication A work well in rheumatoid arthritis to improve the pain and the swelling and the joints and the fatigue.
Okay.
So that distinction between clinical research and epidemiology research I find often is sort of not so intuitive for people.
Right, right.
So that's what sort of one of them is at the individual level, looking at effectiveness of different treatments and medications versus epidemiological research, which is more looking at the level of a population or large groups of people to try to understand things like factors that predict a disease, you getting a disease, or predict the severity of a disease, or that look at the impact of the disease on different aspects of life. And those are usually done through surveys or looking at large databases kind of questions.
Okay. Does one have to do again, another special kind of training to become an epidemiologist, someone who then studies big populations and asks, as you say,
That's
the big
right.
questions?
Yeah, so usually our training will have a component of clinical research,
yeah.
sort of learning how to do randomized controlled trials, for
okay.
example, which are studies where you look at the effectiveness of a medication. And then also some epidemiology courses so that you can understand the studying of health at the level of populations.
Right.
And then you need courses and things like statistics to learn how to analyze the data and what mathematical tests to use to answer the questions and how to translate your questions into a method statistically that gives you the right answer.
Right.
So those
okay.
are the kinds. So usually people will do either a master's or a PhD, but at least another 3 years of training in epidemiology or clinical research, depending on what interests you. So I did a mixture of both clinical and epi.
You did.
Research.
Okay. Okay. And then so
and that was another 3 years.
So start to finish.
13.
13 years. I gather you get asked that
yes,
question
I do.
A lot.
Yes. Yes. And when I tell my kids 13 years in university, they're absolutely flabbergasted.
It's all they can think about to get through grade school at this point. Yeah, I think that for our listener and for people out in the public, there's not a real appreciation for the length of time, just the massive commitment it takes to actually becoming a research scientist.
Yeah.
Whether it be at the basic level or at the clinical or the population health level, it's just
yeah.
it's a significant
it
commitment
is.
Of one's life.
And it's hard because, you know, you ask of clinicians who become researchers to add that on top of their clinical training, which is already quite extensive.
Right.
And you know, people who go straight into research will do a PhD and then they'll do a postdoc, but when you're a clinician, you've had a number of additional years of clinical training on top of it.
Wow.
And that's why I think we have so few people who do clinical research, because it is a huge time commitment. By the time you're done your clinical training, you're ready to go on with life. You know, you're ready to start
earning money,
yes.
Having a family.
Having a house, you know, all those things that you need money for, that sort of even if it's only another 3 years, it's still, or 5 years. I mean, to do a PhD, it's, you know, often more than three. So it does seem considerable at the time when all your colleagues that have trained with you are all opening their practice. And we all have this thing when we're in school that we think life begins once you finish school, little do you know. And there's this urgency to get out and get started. So,
yeah.
So that's, you know, that is one of the reasons. I think the other reason why we have so few research scientists is there's a lot of, you have to live with a lot of uncertainty. It's not a straight path that is traced for you.
Yeah.
You know, it's in today's context of funding, you know, we're all on peer review funding, which means that nobody's guaranteed a salary and nobody is guaranteed money to do the research. So a lot of our time is actually spent writing grants, writing proposals, both for our salary and also whenever we want to do a research project, we have to write out a proposal, submit it to an agency that will fund the research, get it reviewed. It often doesn't get funded on the first try. You get it back, you get your reviewer's comments, you rewrite it, resend it. So it's an arduous process and it's not guaranteed. I think it's another big aspect that does discourage some people from going into research.
Yeah, and I gather
the uncertainty,
you know? Right? And as you say, the limited amount of funding that's available, regrettably, are the cost of disease in general. It places a heavy burden on society, on its budget.
Yes.
And so, if we don't make the investment into health research, we'll never find the answers, presumably, to the questions that are facing us today, and therefore we're never going to really be able to manage the costs that these diseases place on our society. So I think here at ACE we've always and will continue to push for increased levels of health research funding, but particularly in the area of arthritis, which receives somewhere, depending on who's counting, only 1 to 5% of the health research budget in Canada, which when it's the largest burden of disease on society, it's just not enough. That investment just simply isn't enough. So
it's not a good match.
Yeah, we're not going to find answers to those questions that you so curiously are ruminating about. So, well, that's really fascinating. I guess when I hear you talk about how long it takes, and I've mentioned how committed one has to be, clearly you're that. But it's not just being curious, being committed. One then has to be a very good writer, I imagine, because if you don't write a good grant, and I think there's an underappreciation for that whole aspect of scientific work, is the art of writing, writing a grant and getting someone to believe, getting a panel of your peers to believe in your question and believe in the way you're going to go about answering your question. But then furthermore, to be able to get the grant, put it into play, actually operate the grant, and then actually report on the results. So there's a lot of writing. You've got writer's cramp by the time you're done with that process.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of time spent writing.
How long does it take? Let's say you get the research results in.
Yeah.
How long can it take to analyze those? I guess it depends on the complexity of the design.
Really,
but let's just say it's a fairly simple, straightforward question you're asking, and you want to report on those results. Could it be a year?
It's about a year.
Yeah.
You know, when you sort of plan a project, you know, you have to count sort of a number of months of analysis.
Okay.
Because you start analyzing as you start to understand and get results, that sparks more questions and more analyses, and then you go back to the data and you try to figure things out.
Right.
And then, so, you know, that whole process is a good 6 months. Depending obviously on the complexity of the question, it can be longer.
Right.
And then writing is a good other 6 months, if not more.
Yeah.
Just not that you're writing all that time, but you know, this whole process happens simultaneously. So at the same time you're writing grants for the next phase of it.
Right.
At the same time as you're writing up the papers for what you've already have results on, at the same time as you're trying to run other things that are the continuation of what you've done before. So all these phases happen at the same time. So it's not sort of a linear process. You're always doing a little bit of all three.
A juggler. a juggler, a scientific juggler.
Exactly.
That's
like
what
everything
you are
else
in life.
In life,
sure,
you know,
certainly.
We all learn to juggle.
Yeah.
We should all go into a little more circus classes.
When you look at your own process of becoming a research scientist, and you look at your very early work as a student, did it look anything like the work you're doing now at the Arthritis Research Center of Canada? Now you're a full-fledged scientist. You've won many awards. You're an invited speaker to world congresses on arthritis research. You're a highly published scientist. So do you look anything today as a scientist like you looked when you were that kid in the doing the first question? Are you still curious about the same things?
That's a good question. I've never asked myself that. I think, you know, there's one thread that sort of seems to go from the beginning to now, because we always sort of look at our history and sort of follow a thread.
Yeah.
And sort of the one thread, I think, is I've always been very curious about the social impact of arthritis on people's life.
Right.
And there's always been this sort of dichotomy in me. As much as I think on one side, I'm very interested on the clinical, the sort of what people would call sort of the hard science and answering sort of the clinical questions, the epidemiological questions.
Yeah. Why does this person get heart disease? Why does that person get respond to drug A versus drug B,
that kind
of stuff. Okay.
And then there's always been this other side of me that's sort of more the more psychosocial side of me, who's really interested on how do people actually cope with this disease, live with this disease, my very first project was looking at how socioeconomic status impacted people's the severity of the disease in people who had lupus. and how that impacted the healthcare that they used. And now a lot of my research is looking at issues of employment for
right.
people with arthritis. I'm also very interested about all of the coping that people do to be able to, in relation to employment. So what do people do in order to stay at work with
yeah.
their arthritis?
Yeah.
Well, there's a postdoc student that's working with me, looking at the impact of arthritis on people's relationship with their spouse, and all those things fascinate me.
Yeah.
You know, this so that's sort of probably the thread that I see. I don't know I've aged a little bit since then.
No, not at all.
You know, I think I have probably a little bit less of a naive, although I'm
yeah.
still fairly naive. But I think, you know, walking into this, we have a very naive outlook onto research. I had no idea that it takes that long to get any answers, you know. So,
which is mirrored at the public level. I think the public basically, you know, because we're not enmeshed in the research process, I think there's just at the general population level, perhaps a limited understanding and little appreciation for the length of time
yes.
it takes to answer questions. So
yeah.
we as the public are kind of out there going, hey, what are they doing in there?
Yeah.
You know,
why is it taking
so long?
I'd
like to hear about the results from the study I participated
That's
in,
right.
for example.
Yeah. Oh,
so,
I participated in this a year ago. This
yeah.
must be results by
well,
now.
Well, so I'm
but,
glad
you know,
that you've told
really,
us. I'm glad.
Because, you know, for example, I had one of my projects has been developing a program to help people with arthritis remain employed. Well, I wrote this grant in 2000. And,
yeah.
you know, I'm writing up the paper now in 2007. You know, this was a particularly long project because
yeah.
we had to develop a program. So it took a long time developing the program. Then
right.
we had to pilot test it. And then we had to follow people for a year afterwards to get results. We wanted to know the long-term impact. And it was good we followed them for a year because there are certain things that we were not seeing at 3 months and at 6 months, that it takes long for people to make changes at work to then see the benefit of those changes. So we're
right.
actually seeing more results at 12 than we did earlier on. So, you know, this is an example of a project that's, you know, taken so long.
But the public at the final, in the final analysis, the reason why you do that is to make sure that when all is said and done and a recommendation comes out, you're actually giving them evidence-based advice, so to speak.
Yes.
You're saying, look,
it's something to support it.
If you do this, we can say to 80% certainty that you will succeed if you try to follow this program, for example. Or if you stay on therapy A, you're going to have a greater ability to maintain your employment, whether that therapy is massage or, you know, eating popcorn every night or whatever it may be.
Yeah. So it takes time.
It takes time to actually come out with the answer that you're going to feel most certain about
yeah.
and that the evidence supports. So I think that's a bit maybe underappreciated. And the responsibility on your shoulders as researchers is huge, because if you don't do your job well and you're not ethically and morally bound to the process and you give out information that's not quite
yeah.
ready to give out,
yeah.
you know, that's just not, it's not right.
No.
I would imagine there's a, you know, your own code of ethics in the research world.
And you know, when you're looking at outcomes like employment
yeah.
or death, you know,
yeah.
if you want to know if certain medications increase or decrease your risk of death,
yeah.
I mean, those are things that take time
yeah.
to have an effect.
Yeah.
So, you know, people don't lose their job.
Right.
You know, like if you want to be looking at the impact of something on people's ability to retain their job, well, that takes years for you to see a difference.
Right.
So
right.
certain outcomes that are very, very important to people with arthritis, like whether they'll be able to continue working and whether they'll die from their disease, are not something that you can just look at data for 6 months to get the answer.
Yeah. The work that you've been talking about, the arthritis and employment work, that really got its foothold at the Arthritis Research Center of Canada, I understand. Maybe you can tell us just in you know, a few minutes, Dr. Lakai, what the Arthritis Research Center of Canada is and why you call it home and, and what that center gives you in terms of your own research work.
So we're at the Arthritis Research Centre of Canada is a group of researchers that, and I think what sort of qualifies us is that we're all doing what we would call clinical or epidemiological research, so no basic research.
Right.
And we're really looking at it's sort of research on the everyday life with arthritis.
Okay.
So it's a very practical research. I think our tagline is practical research for everyday living with
arthritis.
It
is. Very good. The board will be pleased that you've remembered to mention that.
Well, the reason I mention it is I think it describes very well the kind of research we do.
As do I. All kidding aside, I think it's a great way to describe the work.
So, you know, I do research on employment and arthritis. Mm-hmm. There's other people that are, and I'm looking more at rheumatoid arthritis.
Yep.
Other people are looking at osteoarthritis and psoriatic arthritis. Some people are looking at the impact of arthritis on mothering, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There's people looking at the surgical management of rheumatoid arthritis and the impact of different joint replacement surgeries and
so you have
arthritis.
orthopedic researchers.
Or researchers.
Yeah.
We have. It's nice because we have a very multidisciplinary team. So we have a physiotherapist, an occupational therapist, some orthopedic surgeons. We have a few epidemiologists and a few people like me who are rheumatologists who are trained in epidemiology or clinical research.
Right.
And we all have our niche. We all have different areas, but that's what ties us together is sort of that we're looking at the clinical aspects of arthritis or the epidemiological aspects of arthritis.
Okay. And how long has the center been running now?
Let me think here. Because time flies, you know.
Yeah.
In 2000, 2001, we sort of started working together, but I'm not sure that we were officially a center
formalized,
until,
yeah.
what, 2002 maybe?
Yeah, I think that's about
think
right.
That's
that sounds
there.
Right,
so about
yeah.
5 years. We've
so
certainly
five
grown
years.
A tremendous lot.
How many, what's
years.
The size of the group now?
You know, let me think here how many scientists we are.
She's counting on her fingers, listeners, so...
Yeah, you know, I've got to make sure I don't forget anybody. I won't say any names. I don't know. We're maybe 8 researchers. I mean, you could look
and
it
then,
up on
and
the
then
web,
with
but,
and then with all of the research assistants and
yeah, we're probably a group of I don't know
35, 40.
Maybe?
Yeah.
Guess, yeah,
yeah, that would be my guess
but I
as
would
well.
Sort of. And you know, the thing is, there are some researchers that are there full time and others that are affiliated with the center, but also have an appointment elsewhere. So I think if you counted the people that are affiliated, we're about 10 to a dozen scientists, which is a good
core
critical
group.
Mass, which is nice because it means that we can. You know, if I have a question related to health economy, I have an health economist that I can go to. You know, there's sort of different people with different expertise, but which really facilitates collaboration.
Absolutely, and I guess helps to round out your own and broaden your own view of the results.
Yes,
and how they might be interpreted and delivered back to the public. When you think about the work that you've been doing in the Arthritis Research Center of Canada and its importance, and then you kind of look to the national stage of arthritis and your membership in the Canadian Arthritis Network, how does being a member of a national network of researchers help your own work here in Vancouver at the Arthritis Research Center of Canada?
Well, the Canadian Arthritis Network is a network. It's called a Networks of Centers of Excellence, which is a federally funded network of researchers.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes researchers from across Canada.
Okay.
For me, I became a member of the Canadian Arthritis Network just when I began into research, about the same time as I got my academic appointment. So it was really at a time where it was particularly helpful for me because it really opened a lot of doors for me. You know, the value of the network is that if you have researchers all across Canada that are just working in isolation in their little cells, we have, you know, some productivity, But if you then get all these researchers together to interact and to share ideas and to talk about their research, and then you get to learn from each other's expertise, but also each other's experience, so you learn from what others have tried, mm-hmm. and you get ideas. It's that cross-fertilization. You hear something in a different field, and you think, oh, you know what? That's kind of applicable. I could sort of view that's how creativity of the mind works. Yeah. You hear something in a different context and you adapt it to your context. Or, you know, other examples is that it's really allowed me to have collaborators in other parts of the country, in Toronto and in Montreal, to work on some of my projects that I would never have probably had a chance to meet and to get to know. So it brought for me expertise that was complementary to what was available to me here in Vancouver, so that I could actually get the best team in Canada possible to answer that question.
Right.
So I could get local collaborators. I have local collaborators on my research, but on all my projects, I also have collaborators that are from elsewhere in Canada. And I think that strengthens the research team.
Do you think it also, Dr. Lakai, do you think it also helps to sort of exponentially grow the power of the dollar invested into
totally.
Your work? Because
yes.
you're sharing, you're almost...
It's a synergy.
Yeah, synergy.
It's a synergy. You
yeah.
know, you can sort of each, you know, it's more than the...
the sum of the parts.
It's more than the sum of the parts, you know.
Yeah.
And if you put us all together, it's quite fascinating. I was a little, you know, I was a little dubious at the beginning, but it's quite beautiful to see in a room when you sort of start talking and you actually see the process. You see the energy in a room when you're discussing things
yeah.
of how really the, like I did this for, you know, we had sort of network types of grants that are research initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote a proposal like that and with different people from across Canada.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting where you start off with one idea, but it snowballs. And then by the end of a couple of hours, the whole project has taken a life of its own. And
because you had all this creativity
exactly.
happening in the process.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really exciting just listening to you talk about it. And I know the Canadian Arthritis Network is in its second cycle of funding from the federal government, and I also know that will be ending.
Yes,
and
we're all very sad about
I know.
That, because we wonder how can we continue this collaboration that's been so fruitful.
Well, I think it really has, and I do a fair bit of volunteer work with Health Canada and across the country and other committees, arthritis community committees, and I think the Canadian Arthritis Network has just been this super shining example of how collaboration can really help to fast track not just research but also the development of technology or social programs or health policy, whichever piece of the research spectrum you want to slice through. It's helped in all of those areas. So when we think about possibly the termination of the network at the end of another 5 years, it's sort of frightening. One, because there'll be a significant reduction in funding that will be going
mm-hmm.
into arthritis research.
Yes, that's pretty scary.
But two, think about the all the creativity that may be lost and the productivity and the answers that are coming out of the network out to the community, which it's very dedicated in getting the knowledge it's creating out to the public
mm-hmm.
by collaborating with arthritis consumer experts and other groups in the community. So when you think about the possibility of it ending and you think about the future of arthritis research in Canada, you know, what do you see? What do you see that's new? What do you think are some of the threats? You know, just some free thoughts.
In relation to the network, or just in general? Well, I think, you know, I think in general, I mean, CAN is a good example, all the NCEs is a good example of this networking, but more and more, I think the world of research is moving towards a more collaborative
right.
type of research and really encouraging collaborations across Canada.
Yeah.
And that's why there's all these new emerging team grants and other types of initiatives to foster the formation of teams across across Canada. So I'm hoping that, you know, this process that CAN will have allowed the world of arthritis research to start that process, but that those collaborations will continue beyond CAN.
I see.
Because I think there's a sort of an era or an atmosphere of encouraging more multidisciplinary teams and teams across
multi-institutional. Yeah,
I think we'll have to have, so, you know, that the problem is that the teams that are already established will continue to collaborate, but what you'll lose is those
new team formations
and those new scientists that are coming out. How
right.
will they get linked up with other people?
Right.
And when you look
at the paucity of arthritis researchers, arthritis research scientists, That's a scary thought.
Yes.
That might stagnate is I think quite threatening.
Yeah.
As a person with rheumatoid arthritis, I find that a bit scary.
Yes.
But I'm glad to hear that you're optimistic that the teams that have formed will continue
to
work together, which speaks volumes. You think this process, which really was, I think, a significant culture shift in the research area.
Yeah.
That you believe it will carry on.
Yeah, because I think it's created, as you say, a cultural shift.
Yeah,
and
you don't think people will
continue.
Go back into their silos and
so.
Into their
I
little
think
cells.
The ones that have had successful collaborations won't, because we all see the value of having collaborated.
Okay.
It's a question of having opportunities to be able to foster that. We'll
right.
have to seek other opportunities to help foster that.
And that means cash, obviously.
Exactly.
Something, the opportunity wheel doesn't spin all by itself, unfortunately. Although it, you know, it can if people can be creative at sort of matching dollars and finding new partners and things like that. So that's sort of your views on what will happen with the CAN, that it will continue, that those partnerships will continue, the collaborations. If you were to think about then arthritis research as a whole in Canada and even beyond our borders,
I think
what do you see happening?
I think I've entered rheumatology and arthritis research at a very exciting time.
Mm.
I think I'm very lucky because I, you know, joined right at the time where there's been a boom and an expansion of new therapies that are have become available for people with arthritis after almost, you know, 15, 20 years of very little new coming on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just the beginning of a boom. We've seen the tip of the iceberg. I think there's so many new treatments that are in the pipelines. We've just begun to tease out and get a better understanding of the processes that lead to the diseases and to the manifestations of the disease. And we're now have a whole new category of medications, the biologic medications, that are so much more specific in their action. You needed the understanding to know what you needed to target. Then now we've developed different technologies that are able to be so much more specific.
Right.
And I think it's a booming field. And what we've seen in rheumatoid arthritis, I think we're going to see in the other diseases, in psoriatic arthritis and osteoarthritis. I think the next, I'm very, very hopeful that in the next 10 to 20 years, we will see such a change in the way we treat arthritis.
Boy, that's encouraging.
Very exciting.
It's so exciting just to hear you think that. And I love your analogy, the tip of the iceberg. We've all, as children in science class, you know, seen what that looks like. And below the water's surface is this expanse of ice. And we hope that in arthritis research, there'll be this expanse of answers flowing up to the top.
And I think the other sort of big change, I think, that I sort of see in the future, I think the other thing which also, I guess going back to my thread, is what got me interested in research early on, is that I think we've also started to not just look at the biological process of diseases and just studying and evaluating the biology of the diseases and of the treatments, and we're starting to look at the person as a whole more and looking at the more global impact. So I think we are seeing and will see a lot more research looking at more the psychological and the social impact of diseases such as arthritis, and what can we do to support the person with arthritis so that they can live their life fully while having arthritis, and what are some of the things that we can do outside of giving people medications
right.
to support them in this journey of living with a disease. And I think that, you know, if I was a person with arthritis, I think that would make me, that would be something that would make me feel good to know that finally, you know, I mean, obviously I know you want medications that are effective, but I think that to know that the scientific community is recognizing that we have to go beyond just the treating the medical aspect of the disease, and that we have to look at the social implications, the psychological impact, etc., and it's time that we do something about it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think as a person with rheumatoid arthritis myself, I know that, you know, 18 years ago when I got the disease, there was basically no real information available to me or to my family about the best ways of supporting me, or what challenges may be facing us regards intimacy or my ability to work or not work. And all of that stuff has really come out now, and researchers like you at the Arthritis Research Center of Canada and at the Canadian Arthritis Network are going gangbusters on those areas, and we're very thankful that work is going on. I think it really recognizes the importance of the disease at the societal level, that arthritis is as impactful as cancer, as HIV, as diabetes, that we have to have answers to the questions outside of the medication arena in order to live well in our lives while you're busy looking at the basic science and the medication stuff. So I think your point is really well made, and we're very happy that there are people like you doing the work. It's just fantastic. And before we close today's program, Dr. Lakai, I was not going to let you off the hook by not mentioning your nomination as a YWCA Woman of Distinction. So first of all, congratulations on the nomination. It's really terrific.
Thank you, Cheryl.
If you're unfamiliar with this award, the YWCA Women of Distinction Award really recognizes women in the community who are excelling in a particular area. I understand there are a number of different award categories, but yours is in the health sciences, technology, research field.
It's science and technology.
Science and technology.
Health, per se, is a separate category.
I see. And maybe just we'll close the program by getting your thoughts about being a YWCA Women of Distinction Award finalist.
Well, thank you, Cheryl. I felt really honored actually to be nominated for this mm-hmm. award. I think there are many great women in Vancouver that have done amazing things. So it felt I felt honored to have been selected for a nomination for this award. And you know, we sometimes, you know, we get awards for very specific achievements we do in an area of our work,
yeah.
But I think what's special about this award is that it sort of recognizes the person as a whole,
mm.
And I think that's what I feel is an honor to be receiving.
Yeah. Well, it's really, really special. Superstar young research scientist in the field of arthritis, mother of three beautiful children, wife of a very accomplished teacher, sailor. She does it all, ladies and gentlemen. And we were really just so super thrilled to have you here again today, and we look forward to you joining us again. If we can twist your arm to come back.
Thank you, Shell. It's always my pleasure.
Wonderful. And thanks to you, our Joint Health Podcast audience, for listening. As with all of ACE's programs and services, please keep in mind that the information provided in Joint Health Podcasts is not medical advice, and ACE does not brand or promote any product or company.